Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, and send in a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defense. I'm your host, Stel, and my co-host, or should I say my first co-host this evening, none other than Steve Eyre. Welcome back, mate. How you doing?
Hi, Stel. How are you, mate?
Yeah, all good. Been a bit of a long week.
Lots of football to watch.
Yeah, lots. Too much. Sometimes you get a bit of an overdose, don't you?
Yeah, you pick and choose. I only saw little bits of Sheffield United and Tottenham because I knew that I was going to be caved in for Liverpool and United, and then obviously City tonight against Crystal Palace.
Excellent. But you've been all well, though, yeah?
Yeah, fine. Thank you. Yeah. You?
Yeah. No complaints. Well, I can complain, but I'm not going to go into it because I want to talk about football because that's my escapism at the moment. So there you go. Right. We have a very special guest. This is debut on Shoot the Defence. Hopefully the first of many. I'm going to send him a cap, like you get England caps. I'm going to send him a Shoot the Defence cap. I'll have to get it made up. The gentleman that has been, he's a legend in the media world. What we're talking, 3 World Cups covered, 20 Champions League finals, 19 Champions League semi-finals, Anthony Kastrinakis. Welcome back, my friend. I say welcome back because I'm in my living room and you've been here many times. How you doing, feeling? All right?
Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. How you doing?
Well, I'm a bit miffed at the most important game in English football, which was a bit of a fiasco in terms of the quality of football played by the team with the most championship titles in this country. When you park the bus in the Liverpool Man United game, it's always a frustrating evening.
Well, you've just done the segue for me. You did my job for me. I'm going
to
quit.
We're supposed to talk about football, and you know, with the greatest respect to Steve and Man City, when you talk about English football, you talk about Man United and Liverpool. I was born in Greece, and I can tell you that in the continent, it's like Barcelona, Real Madrid. So I'm not provoking you or prodding you. I hope you appreciate that I'm saying the truth. It is not because I'm a Liverpool fan and you're a City fan. But anyway, I wanted to ask Steve what he thought of United's performance, and then I will give you my opinion.
Is that okay, Stel?
Go ahead, mate. Go ahead.
With a coach's hat on, I thought it was excellent. I really do. Beyond the common myth that is entertainment via media and social media, any coach and manager that goes to Anfield in any era and gets a clean sheet and shakes hand on at least a point guaranteed at the end at full time would snatch your hand off before any season starts in any year. So they're possibly going to get criticised for not having a go. No creativity, no spells of possession, relying on the counter-attack. But the first thing you have to do is keep a clean sheet and guarantee yourself a point. And away at Anfield, it's more than acceptable. Wait for a moment in the game where it'll go your way. It nearly went to Paul Pogba, it nearly went to Fernandes. And we've seen now that Liverpool can be breached at Anfield because West Brom have done it and Manchester United have nearly done it today. But I think if they're going to be classed as title contenders, to go and look and assess the champions over 2 games in a season, if you can draw with them away from home and beat them at home in the head-to-heads, you're going to go close to being top of the league if you're doing that to the champions. So he's done part one of the job today. The harder job is to get the 3 points in the home game. But nevertheless,
when he goes for a win, do you think there's any chance of them beating Liverpool?
No, I thought there was like I thought Liverpool at the Etihad did it to Manchester City, and I thought Manchester United did it to Liverpool today. I looked at the clock; it was 73 minutes, and it just looked like there was a bit of a truce, and there was no way they were going to throw the game open. And I think the commentators on Sky mentioned that if he was, then Mason Greenwood would be entering the field at any moment, and he didn't in that time. So it's easy for me to say that it was a good result for Manchester City as a supporter of City. I still think it was a good working performance for Manchester United. I think it was an excellent point, and I think Liverpool are more disappointed than Manchester United tonight.
Of that, there is no doubt. But the point is, in order to win a title, you need to play football. You can't win a title by not playing football.
No. You don't have to. I know Manchester United have had nil-nils with City, Chelsea, Tottenham, but you don't have to play football for 42 games a season.
You're absolutely right. Not for 38 games, but
yeah.
If City had gone to Anfield and played like this, would you be happy?
Well, City have got an appalling record at Anfield.
I know.
If City, like I say, the head-to-heads are crucial. We don't want to disrespect, you know, a dozen plus teams in the Premier League who are more than competitive. But, you know, you look at your rivals, your competitors, and if you can draw with a clean sheet your away game in the head-to-heads, it's certainly no disgrace. Manchester United will be quite smug tonight. They're not going to be doing cartwheels. I think they'll be quite smug tonight.
The reason I asked you this is because obviously City and Liverpool, the last three seasons, have won the title at a canter, playing attacking football in every match. In every match. Neither your side nor Liverpool have ever played for a draw in the 95% of the matches that they play. And the only time they settle for a draw is, for example, if they're down to 10 men with 3 minutes left or it's injury time. But they always have a go. And when Liverpool draw a match, it's because, you mentioned West Brom. What I told Stel about an hour ago when we first had a chat was that Liverpool faced West Brom today. That's exactly how West Brom played. And you said West Brom breached Liverpool and United couldn't.
No, United were miles better than what West Brom were, and West Brom managed to score a goal against Liverpool, but Manchester United...
I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, but they broke. Like I said, they had the Pogba and Fernandes chances. Unfortunately for United, Rashford was too eager with the offside runs, other than the fact that possibly the ball was a little bit slower. One possible player that could come under scrutiny is Bruno Fernandes, who now being talked about as being possibly the revolutionizer, like since Eric Cantona and beyond, and possibly a cert for Player of the Year ahead of Kevin De Bruyne and Harry Kane. But I want to know: is he a fast track bully that doesn't really do it against the top six or from open play too often?
What do you think, Stel?
About Bruno?
Well, you're the United fan here.
Well, put it this way. The way I see it is that he's done remarkably well since joining the club. And they've turned the corner, no doubt about it. But people were saying the same thing about Lukaku being a flat-track bully. And he was scoring 24, 25 goals a season. So, okay, granted that, I could see Steve's point. But at the same time, you know, there's no coincidence that since Fernandes has come into United, there's been a change, especially in the attacking style. Yeah. Now, granted, today, you know, they defended for their lives. They held on for a point. Don't forget that United were unbeaten in, 16 away games in the Premier League? And you're talking about a Liverpool team that had scored a goal at Anfield for every game for the last 42. So to keep a clean sheet, it's no mean feat. And in the grand scheme of things, that's a big point for United, I think, anyway. If you're talking about top four, even...
I'm not saying it's not a big point. I'm saying that there are clubs steeped in a tradition of playing football. And United were never successful playing counter-attacking football. Mourinho killed the Liverpool United games. He killed them when he was United boss. He wanted a point, he got it. If we nick one, we nick one, so be it. But this is not about the spectacle. This is about the bravery shown on the pitch. Now, was it easier? Let me Was it a brilliant defensive display? Of course it was. Fantastically organized. They played for each other. They had great anticipation. They blocked all the spaces. Of course, it was brilliant. But is that what United is about or should be about? That was my main point. It wasn't questioning the quality of their defensive performance. It was immaculate. Obviously, it was. Liverpool hardly had a chance. And they could have nicked it. They could have nicked it, of course.
Lads, I just think about the Fernandes one. He has revolutionised the Premier League for me. No, it's not even tough for me as a Manchester City supporter. He's moved Manchester United, you know, forward. He's got them back 8 years with his own performances and the fact that he wants to find space with passes. He wants to bring attackers into the game. And I don't think this year is anybody's secret. I think last year, I think the centre midfielders in the Premier League were playing up against him. And I think they were going, well, go on, you're just from a soft Portuguese league and you can't handle it in the shark tank of the Premier League. And I think they basically took their eye off him and he was unbelievable. This year, he's more of a marked man, sometimes by two. So I understand that he doesn't get his own way every week, like I think he did for a spell last year, because he's earned the right to be closely marshalled now in every game and totally respected. But I just wonder, is he actually going to do it in the big games, which turns United into challengers, into title winners? And he'll have to be that person, because he's already took them from not challengers to challengers. If they're going to become title winners again, he has to do it in those head-to-heads.
Just to enhance your point, however, you said 16. It's a year since they lost a game away from home in the league. And he has never lost a game away from home since he joined.
Sure.
So I think he has done it on a few big matches. But the point is, as I understand, you are averse to the cliches of the media. The point is not whether he scores or whether he gives an assist in every match to say whether he had an effect. Because obviously you as a coach will agree, the fact that you may take bother two midfielders for 90 minutes, who are supposed to keep an eye out for you or on you, to keep an eye on you, it means that the attacking prowess of the opposition suffers.
Yeah.
So just by being there, he's affecting the game.
Well, we saw that against Liverpool, because it helped Scott McTominay have one of the best midfield performances of the season, because the fact that he was man-marked in the second centre circle for Manchester United in the number 10 position, he realised he wasn't getting any passes. So what he did do unselfishly, I have to respect, was make unbelievable runs forward, right and left into the channels. The man marker went with him and it just opened up the centre of the pitch for McTominay just to sprint through it with and without the ball and have the game of his life. So I have the utmost respect for him. I'm just suggesting that he's going to have more individual success in the head-to-head games if United are to win the title.
Oh, absolutely. Of that, there is no doubt. He was very angry today because he underperformed, it's clear. But even in a performance that was not up to his, what the cliche would go as his usual standards, he still had the first United shot on target after 74 minutes from 20 yards, went straight at Alisson. And also the biggest chance, other than Pogba, 5 yards out. It fell to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then straight at Alisson. Yeah, so even in a match where he was quiet,
There's a point here that we're getting close to, but we're not actually shaking hands on here. I'm suggesting he will always have those opportunities, but he's going to have to take them if United are going to be first place. And he didn't again.
You're absolutely right on that. And I'm quite relieved about that too, I have to say. He takes that chance. It's a very bad Sunday. Now it's just a bad Sunday.
There you go. Well, I'm not going to ask the boring question, who's the happier manager? Because that's probably been asked a million times this evening. But what I will say, going into this game, I'd have taken a point. And I know, Anthony, you said before that, you know, if United tried to play football against Liverpool, Liverpool would have absolutely mullered them. And I agree with you.
Five.
I agree with you. But what I will say, from a defensive standpoint, I've been very critical of United this season, especially Harry Maguire, especially Wan-Bissaka, who's always this last-ditch defender. And people say, oh, yeah, he's great at slide challenging and all that kind of stuff. But it's like Maldini said, you know, if you're having to make these challenges, then you're not defending properly.
Shaw owned Salah, and he didn't quite own Mané, but Firmino, he certainly kept a very tight leash on Bissaka. But Shaw owned Salah today. You know, it's very simple. That's why Liverpool didn't score.
But what I did notice, and Steve, I'm sure you know, you and many others, even Anthony, noticed that Luke Shaw and Harry Maguire were playing very close together. So it's almost as if they're making the pitch even more narrow and saying to Liverpool, okay, get the ball out wide, but the only thing you're going to do is pop it in the box and we'll deal with those crosses all day long.
Yeah, and you have a mixture of Pogba on the wing. Rashford started through the middle but ended up on the wing. Martial on the wing. They've got to be respected for the work that they did running back towards their own goal, stopping the fullbacks of Liverpool. I don't believe Alexander Arnold has reached anywhere near the form that he was in last year, but up for the same reasons I said about Fernandes. I think the pair of them, you know, they were so respected today. They were almost defensively marked by world-class attacking players who were running with them and stopping them progressing. That allows the fullbacks of United to go narrow, which would suit Maguire because there's no space in the channels. I noticed Maguire against Burnley and again today, he hasn't quite got that pass across the penalty area on point yet. He keeps getting cut out with, and you just feel he's about to be punished with. But he put in a strong performance for Manchester United. I nearly said a leader's performance, but I don't think he's vocal enough. I don't think he's passionate enough. I don't think he looks like he inspires anybody else, but he does keep his own house in order from what was a tricky time in his life. So respect to Harry Maguire, and I think it suits Shaw not flying up and down the left wing, and I think it suits Maguire having him just next to him where they're just looking after their own house.
To say something for Trent's defence, his injury cost him because he started the season really well, but he has yet to hit his stride after coming back from his injury. And the other thing that affected Liverpool, of course, was that Robbo is completely misfiring at the moment. Robertson is not the normal engine of the entire side. What De Bruyne is for City, in my opinion, the left back is for Liverpool. And if the right back and the left back, who have created so much and have basically being 50% of the attacking engine for two seasons, are not playing well, or are not playing as well as they can play, Liverpool have a problem. A lot of the commentary was based on criticism of the strikers suffering and the strike that the defence and the midfield played well, and that's true. United couldn't get out their own half for 75 minutes. However, the fact that Liverpool are not effective in attack is not just down to the front three. The fullbacks have a lot not to be blamed for, but have a great contribution in the way Liverpool attack. And at the moment, they're not doing it, which is why Liverpool are suffering on all fronts. But for Liverpool as well, that's my final point on the game, is they also got a clean sheet.
They did. Liverpool are struggling now. They don't have repeat attacks like they did last year because the best two players who play in the middle of the pitch, you get the ball back for you quickly and start your attacks off again, and now playing centre-half. So Liverpool attack just the once and it's over, where previously it would be wave and repeat of attack because the two lads in the middle of the pitch, you couldn't get past them, a bit like Fernandinho at City. But again, credit to the two lads who have gone into the back line and done ever so well for Liverpool. But of course, it weakens two positions because it takes them out of their strong spot in the middle of the pitch.
They're not comfortable. And that's it. They're missing the energy in midfield. However, I will say, I don't want to be swayed by all the noise about Liverpool are missing the energy of Hendo and Fabinho, because Wijnaldum and Thiago bossed it. Completely bossed possession, completely kept winning the ball back. The problem was they didn't have the spaces and they didn't have the good crosses in that create the rebounds. A lot of the Liverpool goals come from rebounds inside the box. It's exactly what you said. The secondary attacks that you're referring to, many attacks are actually starting from the six-yard box in the sense that they get the rebound. They get so many balls in there that they know one out of seven, one out of 11 will fall in the right player to the right player on the right foot in the right spot. And it wasn't happening today. And that's down to what you were saying about Maguire. because they were so narrow, Maguire was able to deal with all of this. And Lindelof as well. Lindelof had this fantastic intervention from that volleyed cross. The best action of Trent all match, all evening, was when he was wide on the right inside the box and he volleyed it across the six-yard box. And Lindelof, if you remember, intervened and they started a counter-attack and nearly scored. Went to Rashford down the left wing. And it was a very dangerous attack. But sure. I agree with most of the points you make. The only thing I would say is I don't think Liverpool's problem is the midfield per se, because the midfield today was excellent. Thiago was brilliant, apart from two placed passes, but the vast majority of what he did was... In fact, I'm amazed that you didn't sign him, because he was one of the first signings of Guardiola at Bayern. The key signing, and the signing that actually damaged Barcelona more than any other signing, was that he snatched Thiago from Barcelona when he was about to succeed Xavi for just 18 million euros, because that's a get-out clause. So I was amazed we were allowed to get him. I thought City would go in big guns to get him. He's a phenomenal footballer, but again, another one who's still to hit his full stride because of injury.
You were
telling me before the podcast, that because of injuries, we are having the same problems that you did last season at City, you know, and we cannot gain the same momentum that we've had over the last couple of seasons. And that's basically it.
Yeah, fine.
Blended. Well, Rodri's joined us. How are you doing, Rod?
I'm in. You all right?
Yeah, how are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, I'm all right.
Yeah? Yeah. Do you collect pillows or something?
Nah, this is a... this is my big, massive bean bag.
Do you have any pillow fights? Just invite people around and hit with cushions and all that.
you can never have too many cushions. You like to be comfy, don't you?
Fair enough. Well, Princess and the Pea, eh? Look at this guy. Yeah, I know it's a mattress, but you know. We just talked about the derby, mate. What did you make of United?
What, Liverpool?
Well, yeah, well, which other United are playing today? Oh, Sheffield United, should we talk about that?
No, when you said derby, I ultimately think City and United, but yeah. Same old. You know, they're going to come out the traps. I don't know what Micah Richards was going about at half time, because if you leave yourself open or come out at Anfield, that's always been the norm for the last 30 years. You know, you keep it tight first 15, 20 minutes, usually because of the Anfield crowd, but there was no Anfield crowd, but still, you know, 10, 11 days off. They'll be nice and fresh. So they're always going to fly out the traps, but, you know, without really creating anything. And then United really got into it after about 30 minutes. Then they kind of had the best chances, really, in the second half and should have really got the 3 points. But, you know, we didn't get beat. We still stay above them. But, you know, it's people have been talking about United, Liverpool, and then City are just coming up under the radar and just by far the best team in the league at this moment in time. So the way they're playing.
Okay. Well, Steve, let's talk about City then. Pammed Crystal Palace 4-0. Was that 9 games unbeaten now for Pep Guardiola? 5 wins in a row. Crikey, I think Stones and Diaz have played 10 games and they've only conceded 1 goal together. Those two are an absolute phenomenal pairing at this moment in time. And I'll tell you this for now, I called it maybe 2 seasons ago when Diaz was at Benfica. I said, look, this kid is going to be something special. At 23 years old, he's got... I'm going to say it. We've been saying that City lacked that leadership since Company left. I think he's your next Company from a leadership perspective. He's talking, he's commanding. He's even on nickname basis with the players. I mean, he's been there for what? A couple of months? A few months?
Yeah, Stel, once you get a football team, obviously the manager gets hell of a lot of praise, that plays well, is creative, scores goals, scores from set plays, possibly has got the best midfielder in the world in the team. And you manage to, you know, not play your world-class centre-forward who's been there for the last decade, record scoring, goals going Aguero, and all of a sudden find a new way of playing, then you recognise that the coach and the recruitment, lucky enough to have the funds to do it, go out and get the best players eventually. They've not been a full success in the transfer market, but with Diaz, I agree with what you're saying, but once you get your team playing well and winning and scoring, but once they start celebrating defending, just like you celebrate scoring goals, that's when you normally know that you're onto something. There's a spirit, and there's just a real understanding of the whole job of what it takes to win games and titles, and whether it be a clearance. He looks like it means as much to him as a as an assist by Kevin De Bruyne with a cross into the box. So that has spread through the team quite quickly. It looks like everybody is following him and loves defending. You've got to do that first and foremost. And of course, we all know whatever front six City pick are always likely to be breathtaking. So I think we've signed a really good player.
And as for the game itself, Gundogan scored an absolute peach.
Yeah.
Two for Stones. I think the last time he scored a Premier League goal was, what, 2015?
Yeah.
And he's 29. You keep forgetting that he's 29. He's 29.
Like, Stones is 29? I
think so. Isn't he 29? No. How old is he? I forget how old he is. 25? 24?
He's young.
24.
I don't remember how old he is, but
no,
I don't.
24.
If he's 29, I am. I must be 63 or something.
You well, you don't look it. You don't look it. There you go. Well, talk to me about City then, Anthony. They look like they're back in the hunt now. If they win their game in hand, they go top of the league.
Well, I think Steve summed it up perfectly. I mean, you know, City. If you allow City, if they smell blood, you know, it's Jaws. That's it. Steven Spielberg. You know, I think. Obviously, they're the favourites for the title. This is not to heap pressure on them. If Liverpool don't hit their stride, City will win the title. And the whole point of talking about United and the mentality they showed today and against City in the semi-final, because let's not forget, in the big matches, United play defensively. So it's an indication that they lack belief. They lack the belief that they can dominate. But under Fergie, they played, you know, this DNA Cavalier football. Of course, there were occasions where Fergie parked the bus, like the semi-final at the Nou Camp in 2008, the Champions League semi-final. He got the 0-0, Scholes scored from 30 yards, Barcelona couldn't find a goal at Old Trafford, and that was it. You won the European Cup. But that was only in certain moments in United's history and very few matches. Here, there seems to be a mentality. And it's reflected in Solskjaer's words, because he said after the match today that we've come a long way in the last year, and but even longer in the last 6 months. But what does that mean? This is Manchester United, the biggest club in England, not the greatest mind, the biggest. So, you know, there has to be a point where you say United are back to the same, you know, style of football, and they're not. Whereas City play winning football every match. And that's why, regardless of whether you like it, you know, whether you think every foul they commit inside the opposition's half and many times inside the opposition's box is given or not, regardless of that, City play to win. And, you know, the only other side in the country that do it with the same consistency is Liverpool. They're not doing it this season. So by definition, you know, with the exception of Leicester, that I'm not discarding, because Leicester is a phenomenal side, but I agree with Mourinho, even though they're not in the title race, Villa play the best football in England at the moment, the best quality of football. But in terms of winning football, City, by default.
Well, Steve made a point about Sergio Aguero not playing. Do you think that City are going to go splash the cash in the summer to bring in a centre-forward?
Well, me personally, I do. I'd like to think it would be Haaland. He seems destined for the Premier League, despite the advances that came last year that didn't happen. He looks like he's still very much in the potential phase, and he could be a world great that is probably nowhere near that point yet. So whoever gets him is going to get a world great in their team at some point, and there's no reason why that shouldn't be City, United, or Liverpool.
Real Madrid.
You think?
I don't think.
No.
I'm not saying he will go there. I'm saying that that's his priority. And Real Madrid want him because they know that it might be impossible to get Mbappé next summer, as well as the finances might not be there because of COVID. And COVID could determine where he goes. But if Real Madrid do not go for Mbappé next summer, then he is the number one target and he wants to go to Real Madrid. So, it, you know, obviously, if eye-watering some from Real Madrid, eye-watering some from City, I don't know, but of course I agree with you. If they sign, you know, if they sign him, I mean, obviously the only winner in this, apart from the team that gets him, is Borussia Dortmund. But I agree with you; he is the player to get for City. Just like Werner was the perfect player for Chelsea, you know, even though he's not yet the Werner we knew in Germany. Haaland might need a few months of adjustment to English football. But I think he would be fantastic, yes, if they can overcome the Real Madrid temptation and convince him to come here.
There you go, exclusives.
No, it's not exclusive. It's well known in Spain. Been all over the front pages for months now. You know, I'm not telling you anything that any well-informed fan wouldn't know of international football, I mean.
Fair enough. Rod, let's talk about Spurs. Good victory at Sheffield United. I know people are going to say, well, Sheffield United, 11 points from safety, so it's not really a good victory. But given Spurs' season so far, it's been a bit topsy-turvy, hasn't it? So, good win, especially after drawing midweek against Fulham.
Yeah, it was a difficult game against Fulham, and you know, to go to Sheffield United, which is equally difficult. You know, they're where they are in the league, but they've still had a couple of good results. I know they were in the cup, but you know, you've got to build on that. And Tottenham have gone there, gone professional, and got a good result, a very easy win, really. But yeah, it's still a good result in the end.
Did you think Sheffield United might make a comeback when they pulled it back to 2-1? You know, Spurs have been a bit iffy second half of the season.
Yes, but you know, but on the other hand, Tottenham have got that extra level. They could just up at a level, and that's what they did. They got their third goal and just basically seen the game out. But no, to answer your question, no, I didn't. I think, you know, Tottenham have got that extra level, and they showed that.
Excellent. Anthony, I know you watched Ligue 1. What do you make of Ndombele at Spurs so far? Because I know he struggled last season, but it's almost as if he's a completely different player now.
He's Mourinho's favourite player, isn't he? By the way, I hate to be repetitive, but Tottenham have the same problem in what you said about the second half. You know, the team with the fewest shots in the second half. About a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, the statistic was damning. The fewest shots of all the Premier League clubs. And of course, they have suffered from that. They have suffered from basically the counter-attacking approach. I'm not saying that they cannot be challengers, Tottenham, but if you remember, they went to Anfield. Unlike United, they couldn't sustain it for 90 minutes, the onslaught, and they lost. And they lost again the following week. And it's an issue of mentality. And that's why I spoke at length about United. Not because I want United to start winning again, but because I find it strange that they're top of the league and they play cat and mouse football. Whereas City, if they were top of the league, they would have gone there to win, for example. And the Tottenham have the same. And the thing is, this counter-attacking thing started with Mourinho at United, and you know he's taking it to Tottenham now. And I'm not saying that he cannot win with that. Maybe he will beat City in the League Cup. Maybe. Maybe he will win the FA Cup. But I don't think he can win the league because of the mentality. Because in order to take Tottenham to the title, I believe you have to go to the Tottenham DNA. For any team to win the title, Liverpool won the title when they rediscovered playing attacking football. United will win the title when they rediscover playing attacking football. And Tottenham, who traditionally play attacking football, they can't just suddenly become what Chelsea did under Mourinho, for example, a counter-attacking side and win the title. That's my opinion. I may be completely wrong, but I'm telling you how I feel about it and what history shows us in the Premier League. I don't remember a counter-attacking side ever winning. Chelsea deployed it a few times under Mourinho, but if you remember, there were occasions where he would make three substitutions after 40 minutes and throw two strikers and an attacking midfielder on to change a match. So it wasn't as if it was, you know, a set style of play. Whereas at Tottenham, it is.
Okay.
They're a counter-attacking team.
Under Jose, yeah.
Yeah, under Jose, yeah.
Steve, Chris Wilder said a couple of things that interested me at full time when he spoke to the BBC. I think he said it was the timing of the goals, which obviously that's a given. But he reckons that Spurs paid them a compliment by playing three central defenders. I don't know what you make of that. But the other thing that kind of intrigued me even more was he said that it wasn't a foregone conclusion until the last 10 minutes. I'm thinking, well, I don't think Sheffield United were really in the game, even at 2-1.
No, for Spurs to play three at the back, it's not the first time they've done it, so it's not brand new. And I can imagine Jose Mourinho going, well, if we play three at the back and you play three at the back, five at the back, whichever way you want to call it, you've been doing it for longer, but you've been doing it in League One and in the Championship. We've been doing it for less time, but we've got better players. We'll just match you up and our better players, providing that we all work to our maximum and we service our amazing front two, we'll beat you. So tactically, you know, shrewd by Mourinho, but any which way Tottenham wanted to play today, they would have beaten Sheffield United. I heard Chris Wilder talking about it being tough on the workload of the players that possibly needed to dip out for a game, asking them to go again, having, you know, put so much into beating, dare I say it, Bristol Rovers and then Newcastle, as Rodri alluded to. But it was difficult for him to get a tune out of him today. So the result wasn't a surprise to me. And I can't imagine he'd be full of excuses because there aren't any to be had, really, and he's normally pretty fair.
Question for Steve. Three at the back, is it not five at the back?
I said three or five. I don't know. I said whatever's your preference.
The reason I say this is because we're talking about the defensive mentality that he's instilled at Tottenham. You play Sheffield United. Yes, of course, you have to make the tactical adjustments. But yeah, five at the back is five at the back against Sheffield United. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, it depends what the scoreline is, depends what the time is on the clock, it depends what type of an afternoon you're having. So I can't imagine it would have been five at the back too much this afternoon because I would imagine it was in the ascendancy. But normally when you get pinned back, it often leads to, you know, can be a flat back five. And you've also got at Tottenham, you're two holding midfield players that don't really come out the middle of the pitch despite getting through a lot of work. So we know there's a defensive setup. And I agree with what you say about the counter-attacking. It's been enough to move Tottenham forward. It was enough to get them top of the Premier League at point in the last 2 months. But it won't be enough to win the league. A, for tactical reasons, you need to do more to win football matches. And B, for burnout. There's no way the workload of those two centre midfield players and those two centre forwards will be able to do 38 games that way.
Who's the only manager to win with five at the back? Well, three at the back, actually, because his wing-backs were flying wing-backs. In the history of the Premier League, who's the only manager?
Tell me, mate. You tell me.
Antonio Conte with Chelsea, first season.
Yeah.
Which was actually the season that by any stretch, as a measure of who the best manager is, you know, of all the big names in world football, I believe only Ancelotti was missing from the Premier League. It was the first season of Pep at City. And, of course, Klopp, first full season at Liverpool. And basically he switched it after two matches. I remember I was at Cobham and they had basically drawn or lost the first match and he hadn't played the first two matches they drew. And he hadn't played three at the back. So I asked him about three at the back and he said, well, you have to adjust to what the players you've got. Mm. The following Saturday, but he was laughing though because he knew why I was asking him because he was playing 3-5-2 at Juventus. And he was obviously very, very successful with them. But there's a difference between a 5-3-2 and a 3-5-2 if effectively you always have five in midfield. Whereas at Tottenham, when you have a five, you never quite know if that five is a three or a five, if you understand what I'm trying to put up. So only one manager has won with three centre-halves.
Okay. And that was
excellent. Rod, another defeat for Leeds. That's three on the bounce, man. 3-0 against Crawley, 3-0 against Spurs. They lost against Brighton. It was more like Bielsa ball against Beach ball, wasn't it? But Listen, Potter, it's almost as if Brian dictated the tempo, didn't they?
Yeah, it was a very, very, very good goal. So it was a very good goal to win a game. You know, great passing, great movement. You know, a bit like the Arsenal goal in midweek. Very good passing goal, and as a deserved a winning goal. But yeah, Leeds are in a bit of a wet patch in a minute, and you know, Brighton, you know, they're a funny team because sometimes they look really, really poor. But you know, yesterday they looked really good. And like I said before, with a really good goal. So, yeah, Leeds need to, you know, because they're on the wrong way to they don't want to get really involved in a relegation scrap. I don't think they will, but you know, they need to turn around the win rate because it's not going well at the moment. And you know, like I say, the last thing they want to do is get in a relegation battle.
You're right, mate. And Steve, this time Bielsa has actually admitted that he's worried about their winless start to the season. And I can see why. We've spoken at great length about their defensive deficiencies, but again, it was there to see. And Kassir played as well in goal. Someone I thought would never play, especially after Crawley.
Yeah, the young goalkeeper had COVID, I think, didn't he? It was those big, wide open spaces again, which Brighton and Albion play that way anyway, certainly in the home games. And not too often away from home do they have those same spaces that they try and create at home. But against Leeds United, you know, they make big open spaces for themselves. They run around like, I'm not going to say madmen, but that would be unfair because I think it's fairly controlled. But the big open spaces is very much boom or bust, hit, miss, or maybe. Mm. And yesterday you saw that Leeds were leaving the open spaces for the opposition and Brighton had better footballers. Rodri's right when he says it was a great goal. The newspaper might read that it was only from 3 yards, but it was just the weight of every pass, the drawing of the timing of every pass. It was just so precise. And yeah, he had a walk in to finish, but it was a lovely team goal and a shutout from there. You were making a lot of credibility noises about Ben White in the midfield for Brighton still, but I was immediately put off with the short sleeve shirt and the gloves tiptoeing around, but he did have a good game, but he doesn't get the full marks from me because of his appearance. But take nothing away from how he played, because it was a great performance and a result for Graham Potter and his men.
Brilliant. Anthony, there seems to be this rhetoric going around with Bielsa about his teams are going to burn out and they can only play one way. You've been a student of the game, which I say you've been watching the game for a long time. You've seen Bielsa over the years, especially for Bilbao and, you know, for the Argentinian, was it the Olympic team that won it in 2004? So what's your take on Bielsa at Leeds at the moment?
Well, for everyone, you know, I find the cliches of the media in the tabloids boring, but sometimes I find them refreshing. And refreshing is the adjective that they've been using for a breath of fresh air in the Premier League. The reality is, Steve alluded to the performance of Manchester United, you know, McTominay, thanks to Fernandes taking defenders his way. And I'm sure you all remember the analysis and the stop, the freeze frames that showed the vast acres of space that Leeds leave. The template on which Guardiola has based his philosophy is the template of Bielsa at Leeds, but obviously with infinitely more expensive footballers. So when you actually see City play now, and if you see how they've been eliminated from the Champions League last season, how Bayern Munich were eliminated from the Champions League every single season in the semifinals when they come up against a nominal opposition, Leeds will always be caught by the ball over the top or the ball through. And they don't have what they don't have. It's not that, you know, obviously when it works, they get a draw against City. And when it doesn't work, they lose at home to Brighton. What I'm trying to say is that Bielsa this is not a one-dimensional approach or a plan A. This is an idea of football. And when you have an idea and you play football based on your idea, then of course there's no point having objections. It's like Klopp. He has an idea of how to play football, attacking football. That's what I mean by playing football. Because we all know you can organize any I mean, Steve could do it at a Premier League club. He knows how to organise a defence. These are, I suppose, in the licences, the first things you learn is how to set up a defence and how to coach defenders to close down spaces and look out for each other, playing a line. The point is, Bielsa plays a completely expansive style of football, and that, of course, has its pitfalls and its limitations, particularly against high-class opposition. But don't forget that last season, they had a dry spell in the Championship as well, where they were struggling to get results. I like Leeds. Of course, he could modify the way he approaches the game, but I'm sure, as one of the wise men of football, he knows that if he makes adjustments of a defensive nature, he abandons his philosophy. And that may be his downfall, in the sense that Leeds will not be in the Champions League, or they will not finish eighth. They'll finish 12th or 14th, but they will still be great to watch, particularly when they play against sides of their calibre.
We spoke about it last week at the Crawley game, me, Rodri and Stel. And I saw it again yesterday, though. I mean, there's no direct route map that you go from the back to the middle to the front, through the lines, in between the lines. You know, all these coaching words, buzzwords that have been mentioned these days. But more often than not, you try and overload the middle of the pitch. You combine with a few passes and you attack towards the penalty area of the team's goal. That's what the best teams do. Let's say Kevin De Bruyne as the elite midfielder. I'm not even a Leeds United fan, but I am sick of seeing this right centre-half and right-back, as it was yesterday, Ayling, and last week it was Phillips, smack a 75-yard vanity pass over to the left wing. And by the way, it gets there. It's absolutely perfect and it brings itself down. But the amount of time that ball is in the air for it to land on somebody's foot, for him to bring it down, then take a touch and then have another couple of touches to try and commit a defender. 10 Brighton defenders are back defending the penalty area, and a centre-forward is never going to score a goal. And I saw it last week against Crawley, and I criticised that was the route map to try and win the game. And then I'm seeing Ayling do it yesterday. It was a vanity pass. I go, great ball, as soon as it leaves his foot. But I am bored of it after four or five, because it's just a set way of playing that Brighton sussed out easy, and they got numbers back, defended the goal, and kept the clean sheet. I don't think it's rocket science.
Well, Leeds at their best, only one sentence, is when they press, win the ball inside the opposition half and have five in the box available options for passes. That's when they are at their best. When they're trying to build from the back, they always struggle, particularly because of their system where they've pushed everyone forward. So if they lose the ball, they're exposed. And that's what's been happening. Yep. Their pressing has suffered in recent weeks, and that's what has happened to them.
I could forgive it if it was Ronald Koeman. If it was Ronald Koeman and not Luke Ayling or Calvin Phillips. But, you know, it's like 100 foot in the air and then drops down. And that left winger must be thinking, oh, I think if one who's played football has received one of them, you're thinking, oh, what a ball. I better not mess my touch up here. He's stuck right on the touchline. It might be a great ball in terms of technique, but it's just so easy to defend against as a team.
I agree. And I think the problem has been precisely that they have not, they have tried to build from the back and play from the back instead of trying to pin the opposition inside their own half, inside their own 18-yard box, if possible, and steal the ball and score goals. That's what they did well at the start of the season, and that's what worked.
Keep an eye on that right-footed diagonal from right to left and come back.
Oh, I've seen it. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It goes back to what people have been saying about Bielsa, how he's very set in his ways and he's not going to change. But as you guys say, it's quite predictable. So something has to give, no?
I think so. And well, if he's admitting it, he's a little bit worried now. We were worried for him a month ago. He doesn't care for our feelings, but we saw this coming. So I'm sure millions of others have. And, you know, I'm convinced they're going to be in the bottom six at some point, and then we'll see if they're going to be as wide open as they are then. And all of a sudden, you say, hey, lads, hey, a clean sheet and a good point will do us here today. Let's collect something.
The problem is, it's not in his mentality. Sorry to interrupt.
We'll see.
Please carry on.
We'll see. He's not been in the bottom four, five, six of the Premier League, though, yet. But I understand and I respect that and I trust that. I actually believe that, too. But that bottom six of that Premier League can do all sorts to you. And playing your way out of it the way he's trying, it's only going one way.
There is another thing to be said here. For 2 years, he's been chasing promotion. So basically, attacking football is the way to achieve that. And therefore, any bad results, any dry spells, any rough patches, you overcome because you say we have a target. Now, the target is different. Target should be survival, but they started so well. They had such a healthy tally of points, you know, 10 matches into the season, that maybe they got carried away with it. And I think their solution is to implement the things they were doing well at the start of the season more than basically closing things down. Pressing better is the solution for Leeds. And maybe they're tired. Maybe tiredness has something to do with it. Energy levels and how they press, in, they hound in packs. They hunt in packs on the pitch, five or six, closing spaces down. Pretty much what City are doing. But then City are the best coached and the best trained team in the Premier League, are they not? Their fitness levels, I mean, you know.
No, I don't agree with that.
Who do you think is the fittest?
It's not City.
So who is it?
Well, I can't give you a definitive answer, but...
I thought Liverpool, Leicester and City are the three fittest in terms of kilometres covered in the Premier League, distance covered.
Manchester United have kept less players out of the medical room better than anybody. So their medical department's doing something right. Only now has it took De Bruyne and Bernardo Silva and Sterling to get their legs back from not much of a pre-season and a slow start. So in terms of data, I'm not sure. I'm probably only talking about what my eye tells me.
I'm talking over a five-year period.
That's different. I don't believe City are the fittest team in this calendar year in the Premier League.
Maybe not, but it's exactly what you said. Short pre-season, injuries, tiredness.
Yeah, there's another thing as well. They have enjoyable running because they have 73% possession of the ball in every game. So their running is enjoyable running. Their sprints are often sprinting forward. They don't have to do that much sprinting back because they don't get past Fernandinho and Gundogan in the middle of the pitch. So they have the repeat waves of attack. So their running is enjoyable running. I don't believe Manchester United and Leeds United sprint forward and back just as much because they're not heavy in possession.
Southampton might be up there as well. They're a hard-working team, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure.
Very good point. But what I was saying about City is that they run after the ball. They press you so hard. They basically sprint after the ball all the time. And that's why I said, in order to keep 73% possession, it means that you steal the ball so many times and two and three of you hunt a player, double-team, treble-team him, win the ball back. And that's why they keep possession. But those short bursts of energy constantly to win the ball back are there. And to do that...
City still very much are the best in the Premier League. They're not sat on top of it, but they're the best in the Premier League at putting what I call the table tennis table up. They turn you round for the first 5 or 10 minutes and they put balls down the side of you like a Championship and League One team. De Bruyne just puts into channels and the opposition just retreat and retreat and retreat. Then normally, 10, 12, 15 minutes into the game, they push right in there and it's like putting half a table tennis table up and you're just going against the table tennis table, which is sat up and you just can't get out of your half. And that's City to a T.
That's a fantastic image. That's a brilliant point. That's exactly what they are. But to do that, you need to run a lot.
It's enjoyable. It's enjoyable running with because you do most of it with the ball and for your teammates going the best way.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Rod, Big Sam theory. They got the win. They beat Wolves 3-2, but question marks over the defending from both teams, especially Connor Cody, who was hooked. I think that's the first time he's been hooked under Nuno. But yeah, listen, can't take anything away from Allardyce. I'm not his biggest fan. I know you're not. Steve isn't either. I don't know about Anthony. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a win. It's a second win of the season. But Big Sam is just saying, well, you know, we're our head is above water. There's a lot of work to do.
There it is, and he's got, you know, his record speaks for itself. We've never been relegated from the Premier League. You know, that's up against it this year because, you know, this is probably his most difficult task of late. You know, I know he's had some difficult jobs, but this one, when he took over, they were more or less more or less gone. I still think they're more or less gone, but you know, it was like you said, it was bad defending both sides. You know, I watched this game. I watched it all 90 minutes of it, and you know, for Wolves to go 2-1 up at half time, you'd expect them to press on and then to go on and win the game. But you've got to give credit to West Brom. You know, they're down there, they're fighting, and you see it at the end of the game. You know, all the players have got good team spirit, so you know that'll take you a long way if all your players are together and showing that team spirit when you win a game after the game on the pitch, and you could see it. And you know, like I say, that goes a long way. You know, from if players are not together. So yeah, it was a good win, and you know, it gives them a fighting chance, I suppose. But I still think that it's too much for them. But like I said, it gives them a fighting chance.
Yeah, but they got two penalties in that game, and I don't think they're going to get two penalties in a game for the rest of the season. So
No, but they still had some chances, to some good chances to put them away. All right, they didn't put them away, but you know, Connor Cody's was
that harsh. A desperate lunge? Was that desperate from Cody?
Just unlucky, really. Just when it's at speed like that, you know, it's a little move, a little. You know, he would have known he made a mistake, but you know, it's just small margins in the Premier League, and the first one was a stonewall. But you know, you still got to get in there and put pressure on the defenders, and that's what they did. And like I say, when you're down there, and you're fighting for them all them points, you know, you take anything. So. Two penalties, they'll take it, and 3 points, and a derby. If the crowd had been there, it would have been buzzing in there. So, but like I say, it gives them a fighting chance.
Yeah. And Steve, it's almost as if Wolves' luck is slowly, slowly running out, isn't it? And you can see the frustration on the players, that the body language. Saïss was kicking the ball away, remonstrating with the referee a lot. As I mentioned before, Connor Cody had a bad game. Things aren't going their way, and I don't know if I've asked you this before, but this is quite reminiscent of Arsenal when they had that Eduardo injury with Jimenez and Wolves. It's almost as if it's affected the whole squad.
I can imagine, definitely, as a popular teammate. But I think obviously the biggest void is his talent and his goals. Put that with Jota as well. We mentioned earlier, you know, as well as getting in front in games and staying in front, which is always ideal. These lads are talented enough to stay on the ball and press from the front and, you know, link with each other. That's defending in itself, because you're keeping the game in the other team's half. So if you all of a sudden you've got two, they're not world-class, but elite Premier League forwards, one obviously gone to Liverpool and one, the club's talisman, is taking out your team. It affects everybody. We've seen it. So whether that be in possession or just the character or of course, the numbers, the scoring goals. So, yeah, there does. It's not a malaise all over the place, but you know, the mood was probably set by the manager. You know, when he had a go at Lee Mason, the referee, everyone, well, he's a lovely guy, this Wolves guy. Well, they're all good when they're winning, and it just shows you, you know, he's a genius, this Wolves guy. But you need good players. You know, you don't see too many geniuses in the mid-table and bottom of the Premier League. So, you know, the best players turn these managers into geniuses. And when they're not in the team or for whatever reason, the managers, despite his high recognition that we've got for him, high regard, without your best players, you're a less of a manager, no matter who you are.
Yeah, and Anthony, I guess it shows how much of a loss Jota is. Wolves.
Well, you take the two best players. I mean, in fact, I was going to ask Steve if he thought that before his injury, Jimenez might have been a target for City, because he has the quality to play at any big side. I suppose he's not the style of City necessarily, but any striker who can score 20-25 goals in the Premier League with his head and shots from outside the box, inside the box, would interest all the big teams. It's down to exactly what Steve said. If you take the two best players out, and okay, you take one out in pre-season, you take the best player out, where are the goals going to come from? I was very, very optimistic about Liverpool when they beat Wolves, that I consider an excellent football team, 4-0. And yet Liverpool have hardly scored since, if you see what I mean. I think They have an excellent manager who's having to deal with an awful lot of problems because Wolves do not have the luxury of 7 world-class players. They have 2, and they're both out.
Steve, Jimenez, would he be a punt for City?
Before his injury, yeah?
Just short. I'm being greedy. There's no snobbery coming from me here, but like the Jota one was a little bit of a shock, despite his talent that he went to Liverpool. I think if Jimenez went to Manchester City as their next one to share some time around Jesus and Aguero, I just think he's just short of that, because I think in the end, we were hopeful that Aguero would get fit. It doesn't look like he's going to. It really doesn't to me. It doesn't look like Jesus either is going to be the one that steps in and becomes the Terrace hero and centre-forward legend. So I think possibly City have kept their powder dry and worked with what they've got. And like I say, I think they'll go all out and go really, really big in the summer and recruit a centre-forward. I don't think that would be Jimenez. I was asking for
your opinion. If you think, not what they're going to do, but if
I've just given you my opinion. He's short for City. Good for Wolves, possibly too good for Wolves without being unfair on them, but just short for City.
Lovely. A few more games.
What do you think, Stez? Everton or Tottenham?
Could easily be a Tottenham because, you know, to share the workload of Son and Kane, you can imagine Son being able to play in 4 or 5 different positions. All of a sudden, Kane is number 9, but he's now dropped into centre midfield. They've become versatile, just a pair of them. There's definitely room for another forward at Tottenham, for sure. Great shout.
And Rod, you were tipping Jimenez to join United a couple of seasons back and went out and signed Cavani. Similar plan.
Yeah, well, I think if we're being honest, I agree with Steve, you know, he's good, but he's not elite. So, yeah, I think he'd be a good signing for us, but I don't think he'd be a
no. You signed Ighalo, Rodri.
Pardon? Yeah, Ighalo would always be a stopgap, though. He was always like a 12-month idea. He was never going to be a 3-4-year long period. You know, if you bring it in someone like the Wolves fella, he's got to be like 3-4-year plan. Ighalo was never going to be at United 3 or 4 years. Like, same with Cavani. It's just a great sign. You'll be here for a year and a half. Same with Henrik Larsson. You know, these players come along every now and again. You've got to grab him. And Cavani was a great sign, as it's proved.
As was Lappin.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Right, there were wins for West Ham, Chelsea and Leicester. But the final subject I'd like to discuss, gentlemen, is about a team that's actually playing tomorrow, and that's Arsenal. Mesut Ozil is gone. Fenerbahce have officially announced it on their Twitter account. They've got photographs of him coming off the aeroplane with his wife and his child, and he's draped in Fenerbahce scarves. Steve, 300k off the wage bill, apparently, a week for Ozil. Finally, the saga's over.
Yeah, the biggest winner is Mikel Arteta. He's not got any dirty laundry in the press. He's always maintained, you know, he's been touched on the subject, but he's only always maintained class, dignified replies of, no, he's just not in the setup. He's not in selection. He's not give you a reason why. He's left you wondering, but he's not, you know, outwardly criticised him, and it's just flushed out. It feels like it's just flushed out. There was a time when Arsenal were struggling that I and many were suggesting he should be in the team. But fair play to Arteta. He held his nerve. He must have thought about it under peer pressure and media pressure. And his team have blossomed in the last 5 weeks without him. And then the exit has just been like matter of fact. And like you say, it could even, it's 300k a week and he's been a great player, the king of assists at one point, it'll be thought about in one moment and I think it'll be forgotten the next day.
Absolutely. And Rod, I was praying that this move would happen because it's Fenerbahce. What were we saying about Mesut Ozil 2-3 seasons ago? What does Mesut Ozil wear? What does he need to wear? High vis jacket.
What do you mean?
Well, he used to go missing, so that's what I said. Wear a high vis jacket.
Yeah, he just go missing. But when he's on form, he's playing. You know, he's a good player.
Yeah.
But yeah, for like Stead says, for Mikel Arteta, just get him out the door. Just get him out the door. Free that wage bill up. And just it was just a weird situation. There's such a good player and such a big wage. You know, it's the same thing with Alex Sanchez. Thing. I just don't understand why you bring these players in. Well, I can understand why they brought Ozil in, because he come from Real Madrid and he was on fire when he come in and he was a good player. But yeah, the way it turned, it's just a weird situation, and just probably Mikel Arteta is glad it's all over now, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
And Fenerbahce shirts are bright yellow, so there you go. He's got his high-vis jacket.
There you go. He's got his high-vis. Yeah. So.
Anthony,
look out the goats.
Jesus Christ. Anthony, what do you make of this whole Ozil situation? Because, you know, you're not on social media, you're not on Twitter, but you've got Arsenal fans that wanted to keep Mesut Ozil for whatever reason they had. And you've got Arsenal fans that are saying, well, massive wages, his attitude is rubbish, he's got no interest in the club, he's got more interest in his social media and his esports team. I'm sure there are many Arsenal fans, even Arteta, as Steve said, they're actually glad that he's finally out the door.
For me, I never understood all the fuss and all the hype. I had a call from the king of the German press a couple of weeks ago, who asked me my opinion on Ozil. And I told him, a total disgrace. He said, that's exactly my opinion. I always thought he was overrated, he said to me, and I had to hear all the German, and we are talking about a complete legend. I'm not going to mention his name, but the greatest German journalist of the last 30 years, football journalist, who has seen it all. 300 grand a week to go missing. And it wasn't just that he went missing. I'm not an Arsenal fan, but I covered Arsenal for many years, and including after his arrival. The reason he came in for 50 million euros, 42 million pounds. Real Madrid had bought him for 12 million euros. So Arsenal paid four plus times what Real Madrid had paid only a couple of years after he joined them. And his original wages were about 180, but it doesn't matter, they're obscene wages anyway. But to give him 300 grand a week for what? He had shown that he doesn't run, that they're always a player short when it comes to pressing, that they're always exposed. Yes, good player. At Real Madrid, he was on it. He was switched on. He was sprinting left, right, and center. At Arsenal, he was coasting. And he was picking up, and not only was he coasting, they gave him their biggest contract in their history. The same calamity that United suffered with Alexis Sanchez, Arsenal suffered with Ozil. And you know why he came in? To keep Gazidis back then in a job. Because they had to make a marquee signing. They didn't need him. They didn't need him. And they paid a massive price that runs into the tens and tens of millions. Over 100 million pounds, probably. 15 million a year for the last 3 years, 45 million, 3.5 years. 45 million only on his wages, plus 42 to sign him, that's 87, plus the wages until his second contract, it's over 100 million. They wasted 100 million on Ozil. That's my opinion, and good riddance.
So, is this the final club of Ozil's career? Fenerbahce, he's obviously got the Turkish heritage. Is he going to set the Turkish league on fire?
Well, he's certainly going to ignite passions. And, of course, I'm sure there are thousands at the airport for his arrival and his presentation. COVID will go out the window. You know, he is extremely popular in Turkey, despite being a German international. He is an idol. So great for him, great for him. Pampered here, pampered there, even more so. Whether he will turn it on the pitch remains to be seen. I hope he does. I'm not saying he's not a great talent. What Steve said is correct. If he was applying himself, if he was sacrificing himself out of respect to the fans that pay the hard-earned money, then he would be one of the all-time great European footballers. Instead, he is a waste, in my opinion, of course, based on what I've seen.
Fair enough. Yeah. I don't think he's gone to Fenerbahce to play Champions League football because they're not in the competition. When was the last time they were in the Champions League anyway? I can't even remember.
Not that far back, but anyway, they could be in the Champions League next season. You know, that's not the issue. It's not about the Champions League. It's about what he does, how he trains, how he applies himself, the kind of sacrifice he brings for his teammates and the fans on the pitch. That's my big objection.
When have we ever talked about a Turkish team or a Turkish team in the league? Or it's like Cypriot league, tin pot.
I'm not going to buy it. I saw what you did in the WhatsApp group, Rod. Okay. I'm not going to buy it.
Well, it has to be said that they have, you know, by size of country, they're 100 times bigger than Cyprus. So, no, Turkish football, obviously, they've had their successes. They've been in the last four of a World Cup, you know. They've even won. They've even won the UEFA Cup against Arsenal, didn't they? In 2000.
Yeah, that's right. Naeem.
Naeem or Zaragoza?
Against Tottenham, yes. But Naeem is not Turkish, is he? He is Moroccan. Tunisian or Moroccan, isn't he?
One of the two.
I don't remember. I may be wrong. He may be Turkish. I don't remember.
Sure. Moroccan, oh. Eh?
Best Turkish player to have played in the Premier League is two guy. That's my opinion.
Class act.
Right, gentlemen, that's it for another episode. Thank you ever so much for jumping on board. It's been fun. Rodri, anything you'd like to plug?
No, I mentioned the Cypriot League tin pot, but nothing else than that.
This guy. Where's your dog?
He's downstairs.
Steve, that's again, mate. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, mate. Thanks for having us, lads. And good to meet you. And I'll see you again on here.
Get back to that painting, Steve.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying.
Listen, that free kick you took against Joe Barton was pretty decent, I must admit.
Yeah, well, yeah, I prefer it when there's a wall there. It's a bit more real.
Great stuff. Anthony, thank you very much.
And there's an adult in there.
See you, lad.
Okay, Anthony, thank you very much. That's it, guys.
Thanks for having me.
It was an absolute pleasure. So, guys, until next time, take care.